Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eddie Lucio, and I'm here representing Alvaro Garcia, the appellant in this matter. A quick background into the case. Mr. Garcia was a police chief in Palm Valley, which is a very small city with a very small police force. I believe they have probably five police officers. Mr. Garcia is also an instructor for various training courses for officers and has been doing that for numerous years in South Texas as well. So the reason we're here is because of one of these courses that he was the instructor for. And the attendance of some of the police officers at this course. There are some forms, attendance or roster forms, training for forms that are there present in the class, and when somebody walks in, they'll sign their names that they're there. So he was arrested and indicted because three of the people that are on that list were not physically present at the class, and instead did self-study and eventually went on to pass the class. So he was indicted for three different counts of tampering with the government record, a state jail felony. The first issue that we'd like to bring up, and we brought up in our brief, is the fact that it's our argument that this roster, this attendance form, is not a government record as required by the statute. The reason we say that is because there's two entities that exist here that monitor these trainings. One is TECOL, and the other one is the TMPA, the Texas Municipal Police Association. Now, there's no dispute that TECOL is a government entity. And there's also no dispute that the TMPA is a private nonprofit entity. So I think both sides agree as to the status of these two entities. The document at issue, these attendance forms, there was never any evidence presented that TECOL ever prepared or promulgated these documents. All these documents, the only evidence was that they were somehow may have been generated by the TMPA.
But the state has argued that once the documents were transmitted to the TECOL, sounds like some kind of electronic transmission, I'm assuming, that once the records were obtained by TECOL, then they became a government record. So the question for you then is, who submits them to TECOL? Did Mr. Garcia submit them to TECOL, or does someone else with TMPA submit them? TMPA submit them? Because the question would be is, at the time he submitted them, did he do so knowingly that they were false?
Well, let me answer that in two parts. First, the first part, I agree with the court's categorization of this, that we have to assume that somehow it was submitted by the TMPA to TECOL through some sort of electronic service.
Well, we don't want to assume anything. We wouldn't know what the record shows.
Well, the thing is, the record doesn't show that. The government never presented, the state never presented any evidence of how. They do present some evidence that it's input into a TCLEEDDS, but there was one reference to it, but there was no elaboration on how that got done, who did that at the TMPA. We know that it's the TMPA that submits that information to TECOL.
But we don't know what TMPA submits, because that was our discussion this morning.
Correct.
At the time that this electronic filing, because just taking a step back, Texas Penal Code section 37.012A says government, under definition of what a government record is, this is anything belonging to, received by, or kept by a government for information, including a court record. So it's the received by that we're all, you know, looking at. When it's received by TECOL, and we were looking at that testimony, I forget by whom, Chief, as to this upload, we were trying to ascertain exactly what that meant. Was it the roster that is scanned and uploaded as a document by TMPA, or what it is done? But more importantly, what did Garcia know of what was going to occur with this roster? So that is what we're focusing on here this morning.
Well, this again, what did Garcia know, and how is it transmitted from TMPA to TCO? The government, the state, never presented that evidence in trial. It came up that it was submitted to the TMPA, and that somehow the TMPA submits it to TCO, but they didn't specify that. What the record does show is that the form that Garcia prepared winds up at the TMPA and never leaves the TMPA. It stays at TMPA. That document itself is not sent to TCO.
The physical document the itself physical remains document, there, according to Flat, for at least 5 years.
It stays at TMPA, and after 5 years, they destroy it. So that document itself that Mr. Garcia submits only winds up at TMPA, and they're the ones that keep it. TCO does not keep, and they don't have any database where they're storing all these documents that instructors like Mr. Garcia prepare. The government didn't present that evidence. Even if, for example, somehow they were to try to argue now that TCO obtains some of that information in some other format and then stores that other information, they didn't present that information at the time of trial. So
does it have to actually be the document, or is it the document derivative of information that becomes important under this definition of government
record? Our position would be that it's the actual document that has to be kept by the government entity, or else it wouldn't be a government document. For example, these forms can exist in any different format. Any instructor can prepare his own format and probably submit it to the TMPA and say, I affirm that these people were here. There's rosters as we walk in here. Just because somebody signs them doesn't necessarily make that a government record. There's no law that says...
Okay, well, just for the record, we don't keep any of those signatures. I don't want to get
in. I was just thinking, what do we do with those?
I think they end up in file 13 right by our clerk's office at some point.
Well, here, they didn't wind up with any court or anywhere. They wound up with a TMPA, and we know they don't leave. Somehow the TMPA, and again, it was not really elaborated other than there was one statement in the record that it gets input into the TCLEDDS system. Nobody identified the system. Nobody identified the system. Nobody said who entered into the system. There may be an argument that whoever generates that, I don't even know that that's creating a government record, but maybe there's an argument at that point somebody's creating a government record. But that's not Mr. Garcia doing that. That's some other individual doing it. If that individual then does something, there might be an argument at that point that that would be a tampering with a government record, because that is something. But that's an electronic transmission that we assume that's what it is, because the record doesn't elaborate into what was done there.
And it doesn't matter for the definition or under this penal code that the information that is created by the government entity, TCLEO, was derived from falsified information or incorrect information, however you want to describe it.
That's not their response, and that is not what was argued at the time of trial. I mean, an argument could be made now, after the fact, but it'd be very difficult because they didn't present that argument to the jury.
What was exactly the indictment against Mr. Garcia? Do you recall?
It was tampering. It was three counts of tampering with the government record. And since the report...
intent to defraud the TMPA, right? That's under the indictment.
Yes, and the TMPA is a private entity. So, so there were state jail felonies of tampering with the government record. And the reason it's three is because they separated it out for every page of the roster that was there.
Well, arguably, there's three different days, three different signatures each time of the different people.
Yes, and that takes me to our second argument, which I can move into unless there's some other questions on that.
No, please,
so,
proceed.
So with that, in their response, the state now makes the argument that they indicted this on a per day basis. But if you read their indictment, the days stay the same for every single count that they allege. The only thing that's changing for them is the page number. So they're basically saying on these days, on this page, and then they change the on the next count, it's page 2, and the next count is page 3. So they didn't say on August 23rd this happened, and then on the next count, August 24th this happened, and on the next count, August 26th or something like that. It was all basically on the same, the dates are not changing. What they're doing is, the only reason there's three counts is because they did it per page. This was actually one course, one submission of this document, this roster, which technically is not a government record. So we believe that that's a violation of the double jeopardy clause for multiple punishments for the same offense. There's different scenarios under which they could do this. They could have done it per person. I mean, they could have I think they could have done it up into like
30?
You know, at least 9 different counts every single day for every single person. And lead up to 9 different counts. But again, it would have just been the same, still tampering with a government record, one submission of this document.
But isn't every signature a different fraud upon the same document? I mean, it could, you would agree with me that the tampering with government records could occur multifarious on one document if you sign the same fraudulent or the same tampering. Let's assume it's a 3-page document and you make 3 different changes on it, taking aside whether it's a government record or not. That would be 3 indictments if you tamper with that document in 3 different ways, which is what I believe the state is arguing.
Well, we would argue that it's not, that it's just tampering with one government record. If you put a name in there and the date might be a different date, I don't think that would be a separate count or a separate tampering charge, because you're still only tampering with the one government record.
And here, had they indicted with the 3 different dates, would your argument be the same?
It would be a different argument if they had indicted with 3 different dates, because they would have alleged it happened on 3 different times. But they basically said one document.
My understanding is that they went in, according to the evidence, if I remember correctly, he didn't sign it. He went in once and signed it simultaneously on the 3 different pages. It wasn't like he signed one page one day, the second page on a different date. So you couldn't have indicted for 3 different dates, because he fraudulently, if you believe he fraudulently, which is what was he was convicted of, he tampered with that document once, 3 times, one on each different page.
Once with 3 different people, though. So that's right. That was sort of your point. Yeah, I did the math wrong.
Right? Yeah,
so I did 10 people per date.
You know, could they have done it that way? They could have done it. They didn't do it that way. So I think at this point it's, you know, somewhat moot to try to argue what they could have done and should have done.
Right.
I mean, they may have tried. It would have been better, I think, for them to have done it 3 different days or maybe per person, but they did one document every single day. And this moves in a little bit into the argument of whether this was even a falsification of this thing, or whether this was even wrong to begin with. In this case, the primary testimony, there were the officers that said we weren't there. But then there were 2 witnesses. One of them worked for TCOL and the other one worked for TMPA. And they're the ones that came in without any objection, which is my ineffective assistance counsel claim. They weren't listed as experts. I agree with the state that no motion to disclose experts was ever filed by the defense attorney, which for us just makes it even worse, not better. The fact that no motion to disclose experts was ever filed, these individuals got up there and testified as experts. They were not listed as experts. There was no objection. There was no drawbird to them. They basically said, there's a distinction between fact witnesses, and there was some factual testimony from them. I did this, I saw that. But then they took it a step further and went into, based on all my training, background, education, experience, these is the way it's supposed to be done, and these are what these terms mean. And they started talking about self-study.
Well, I want to interrupt you because I know that the yellow light went on. That was going to be a follow-up, and I'll let you answer this question, as to whether this was actually a falsified record or a fraudulent record. Was there anything to indicate on any of these documents that they had been present or needed to be present or mandated to be present in a classroom for those 8 hours and not be available that they took the course other than in that room for those 8 hours?
I don't believe on the actual document it says that. There's a separate document, a contract between the TMPA, I believe, and TCOL that says presence is required or something to that effect. But on the actual roster itself, it doesn't say presence required or something.
And is there any document at any time that Garcia signs off that says that these people were present? As lawyers, you know, when we go to the CLEs, we attest that we were there and present. Is there any of that document that was presented as evidence in this court?
Nothing that says I attest they were present. It's just he signs the documents, if I recall correctly, and there's the people's names, but I don't know that there is an affirmation. I'm pretty sure there is no affirmation. I hereby affirm that there. I could be wrong on that, but
because it would seem that one of your other arguments is that
the state will point it out.
That they were not fraudulent, that what he submitted was not fraudulent.
Yes. The only evidence that they presented that this was, well, not necessarily fraudulent, but that it was, one of the witnesses said it was just wrong for him to do this in the end, which is another issue without objection. But the only evidence came from these two individuals who were testifying as experts. And again, the defense counsel did try to present some expert, but then on voir dire challenge by opposing counsel, he just withdrew it. So I think all these things together add up to an ineffective assistance of counsel, how individuals were just able to get up there without objection, testify. They were interpreting contractual terms between the TMPA. They were talking about how self-study applies in some and doesn't apply in others.
Okay, your time is out. You can follow up and rebuttal on your additional arguments. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to start off by thanking this honorable court for allowing me the opportunity once again to present oral arguments. I know not every attorney is afforded that, and I appreciate that. It's my third time here.
You're welcome.
And I'm very thankful for the opportunity. Regarding the appellant's first point, he says that the evidence isn't insufficient, that it's a government document. Now, the cases that he cites are Constructors Unlimited and the Pokladnik case. And he cites that in those cases, it's true that the appellate courts held that the conviction had to be overturned because at the time of the false entries to the documents, that it wasn't a government document at the time. And then later, if it was submitted to a government agency and it became one, that it didn't matter because at the time he made the false entry, that it wasn't a government document. And the appellate courts
held...
It wasn't
a government entity.
A government entity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, Your Honor. And so that was true. Now, the important distinction here is that those cases that the appellant cited, Constructors Unlimited and Pokladnik, all based their indictments on 37.10A1 of tampering with a government record. Now, there's six ways, of course, according to that law, as we know, to commit the offense of tampering with a government record. Now, those two cases that appellant cited are the indictments in both of those cases are based on 37.10A1. Now, I'd like to point out that our indictment in our case and the jury charge in our instant case that's here before the court was not based on 37.10A1. In fact, it was based on 37.10A2. And the reason I it's important to point this out is because it's a critical distinction here, because the Constructors Unlimited and the Pokladnik holdings don't apply, because in those cases it was required that at the time of the false entry or the fraudulent entry that they be government documents at the time. And if we had indicted it under that one, under that statutory language, A1, then the appellant would be 100% correct. But however, we did not. We indicted him under 37.10A2. And on that one, it says that a person commits an offense if he makes, presents, or uses any record, document, or thing with knowledge of its falsity and with intent that it be taken as a genuine governmental record. The important distinction is on this one, there is no requirement that at the time that he wrote in the fraud that it be a government record at that moment, just that it be done with the intent that it be taken as a genuine governmental record, which we argue that's exactly what happened. In fact,
I think that what's missing still, though, even under A2, you need to look at one case that wasn't cited on either of your briefs that came out of our court, which was the Chambers case that was authored by the chief as to what is a government record. So looking at that one and looking at the Vasayas case as well, it does seem to indicate, though, as to what is a government record and what isn't a government record. And it's still a question as to whether this document, whether the state proved it was a government record or not. So how do you make it a government record, as we discussed this morning, when it is submitted to TMP and never submitted to a government agency?
On the seventh volume of the reporter's record, in pages 22 to 42, where Sergeant Onveda testified, I read in the reporter's record that Sergeant Onveda testified that the roster with the fraudulent entries was submitted from appellant to TMPA to T-Cole. So,
but how?
How?
Can you
it doesn't
that?
Say if it was faxed or emailed, scanned, or you know, it doesn't say that.
Well, is that sufficient for our purposes?
I would say so, because there is no other information. That the very fact that these three officers who testified, they all testified that they did not show up, even though the roster says that they completed the course. That very essence that's the fraud. The fraud is that they completed all 24 hours of the course.
But the fraud has to be made on a government record. And what Mr. Garcia signed and submitted to TMP, at that point, I think all can agree, is not a government record.
At the moment he's made the fraud correct, it was not
a government record.
Absolutely.
The question then becomes, does it become, for the purpose under this statute with Mr. Garcia, when TMP, not Mr. Garcia, uploads whatever he uploads, does that make the roster government record? And i.e., does it then give fraud to Mr. Garcia?
I would argue that it absolutely does, because the very essence of including those three names, as we know there's 10 on each one, we've only alleged that the last three are the ones that are fraudulent, and each of those three officers testified that it is 100% true that they did not attend any of the class in person, that did not happen. They all testified that. Two of them claimed that they did self-study with only 2 hours per day with the instructor. And then a third one said, I didn't even do that. I didn't even do self-study. There was no evidence that they actually did self-study, but two of them claimed that. I would argue that combined with a contract with the appellant, wrote a contract with TMPA where it said in the contract, and he signed that this information was going to be submitted. The whole point of the course is to get T-Cole credit, and it stipulated in the contract that he signed that said that it was going to be administered by him. He's the instructor. It's going to be sent to TMPA, which is contracted by T-Cole to set up courses and be able to have officers get the T-Cole credit. And then, of course, the whole point of it was to give it to T-Cole so that T-Cole could issue their T-Cole credit, which is required.
So, and I'm assuming that contract is in the record.
Absolutely. It's a state's exhibit.
And that's how his knowledge, I guess, of these requirements is established.
Exactly, which is the whole point. And then earlier the court also asked on the rosters themselves, which are state's exhibits 1, 2, and 3, there's a statement right above his signature and his printed name where he certifies, and I quote, these students have completed this course and are approved for credit. And the contract stipulates that he signed, says that course completion is defined as full attendance and completion of the final exam. Now, they completed the final exam, their defense exhibits, but the officers themselves testified that they did not attend the course at all. And even if some argument could be true that self-study is allowed, they're certifying they did 24 hours. The two that said they did self-study only did 2 hours. And then the third one said, I didn't do any self-study at all.
Well, I think without a doubt what Mr. Garcia definitely did was breach a contract, definitely did not follow the TMP protocol. The question becomes, in doing all those things wrong, is that a violation of 37.1A2 going back to, does all that substantiate this government record definition as set out? Because imagine in the big picture, if the court allows documents that are not government but end up in the hands of government, all become a violation of 37.10A2. That's all encompassing a lot of documents that we all sign that end up in government institution hands.
Sure. And the critical,
for example, you get car insurance and you submit your car insurance in order to get your registration for your car. That is now a government agency record, and if I didn't have that insurance right, then I'm committing fraud under A2. You see what I mean, why it's important that we ascertain what government records is?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I believe the critical distinction here is that the appellant made the fraudulent entries that he knew were false for the sole purpose to deceive T-Cole so that he could receive credit for teaching the course, and for these officers that are some of them were his officers, that they received the credit. He knew it was false, and then the whole point was that it was his intent that it be taken as genuine entries. That was why he did it. If not, he wouldn't have included them, because there was also a requirement that in order for the class to count, there had to be a minimum of 10 students. So if he hadn't included these three fraudulent entries, the class wouldn't have been able to be held, and nobody would have gotten credit for it.
Counsel, you just said that he intended to defraud T-Clo, correct?
He intended to defraud everyone, TMPA and T-Clo, ultimately T-Clo, because TMPA is not the one, of course, as we know, that actually gives the credit. The T-Clo is the one that does it. So he intended to defraud TMPA and T-Clo.
But he was indicted.
Correct.
Defrauding TMPA, correct?
Correct. That's correct. Normally it would be a Class A under A2, except it's a state jail if the intent is to defraud or harm another. However, there is no intent that defrauding or the harming be a government agency themselves.
And counsel, who has legal authority over this document? Is it TMPA? Is it T-CLO?
Well, appellant, of course, filled out the document and it was submitted to TMPA. And then that same roster, according to the 7th volume of the reporter's record, Sergeant Olvera testified that roster with the fraudulent entries was submitted to T-Cole so these officers with their PID numbers so that they can receive credit, you know, I guess equivalent to our bar numbers, what it would be that we would get. And then that's the only way that they would know that without the fraudulent entries and the roster that he signed and that he created, T-Cole would never have given these officers credit, despite them testifying that they did not complete the course.
But I think Justice Silva's question is, who does that document belong to? And I think that document belongs to TMPA. It never belongs to T-CLO.
It was given from appellant, correct. It was given from appellant to TMPA. And as far as the physical document, I don't know who has the physical document. That's not in evidence. I don't know.
I thought TMPA testified that they kept that roster for 5 years. So they TMPA.
They have a copy or the original. I guess that's what I meant, that they don't have a copy or original. I don't know.
Well, you keep saying that T-CLO has it, and I'm not sure. I'll go back and reread that record. I am not sure, along with Justice Silva, that they actually physically ever actually end up with that roster in their hands. T-CLO. Okay. Is that how y'all say it, T-CLO?
T-Cole.
I think T-Cole, right? I think so. I don't know either. But the only evidence I could find in the record is from the 7th volume, where Sergeant Olvera says that roster with fraudulent entries is then submitted to T-Cole. So from appellant to TMPA to T-Cole. And the only way T-Cole would even know about those people with the fraudulent entries is because the appellant put them in when it was clearly false.
Okay. Thank you.
So regarding the double jeopardy argument that they say...
You're asking for additional time since your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that.
Well, you reserved
yes, thank
10
you.
Minutes, but...
Thank you.
May I please report?
The first thing I'd like to do is somewhat correct a little bit of that argument. There was a little bit of playing a little loose with the facts in terms of it gets to T-CLO's. The evidence at the time of trial on the record shows, and I quoted it in my brief, that this document stays with the TMPA the entire time. And I quoted the actual language and cited to the reporter's record from the TMPA individual. They did make a reference during trial that somehow this information gets entered by TMPA into the TCLED's system. But nobody elaborated how that was done. So there's no evidence in the record here that the court can consider in terms of, I mean, everybody just assumes, and I did too as well, that some sort of electronic submission of entry of information, but the document itself never leaves. There's reference to a contract.
And does that matter? I mean, does it actually have to be the actual document that ends up in the hands of the government agency, or is it sufficient that the information from that document is submitted?
We believe that it's the actual document that has to be, because it is a tampering with a government record. And this has to be a government record to begin with. There's no evidence that this document was ever generated by any government agency. And there is evidence that it was never submitted itself to the government agency. So the question this court then, I guess it's a good question. We believe that it's the actual document, because at some point we don't know. I do believe that it's information. Well, even then, if the person that submitted this is just doing some sort of input of information, I don't know whether that's generating a separate document. Again, they didn't argue this at the time of trial. The case was not indicted that way. It was not even indicted that the document was submitted to TCLED, submitted to the TMPA, a private entity. So I would think that that might be a question of first impression. I would argue that it's the document itself that has to be a government record. This one isn't, clearly. There was some discussion about a contract. The contract was not with the appellant. The contract was with the TMPA and TCLED. There was no contract that Mr. Garcia entered into with TCLED itself. So he didn't breach a contract with TCLED. He didn't have a contract with TCLED. So those are the two issues I wanted to respond in my rebuttal. And I have nothing further.
Okay.
Thank you.
Interesting case. It will be under submission.
Thank you, Your Honor.